The views expressed on this broadcast of Speaker Monday with your host, the Monty Man, do not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHLT Recovery Broadcasting or its affiliates. KHLT is not affiliated with any particular 12-step fellowship.
Just when you think you have all your ducks in a row, life takes a spin. It happens again and again. It seems to me that when I take my will and let you go without a pause, I've been living, that's a fact. Let it go and stay out of my own way.
Welcome to Speaker Monday with the Monty Man. Each week, Monty brings us speakers from a variety of 12-step fellowships. Now here's the Monty Man with this week's speaker.
Well, greetings, friends and family in recovery. Those of you who are advocates of, and perhaps some of you who should be, welcome to Speaker Monday, another fine episode. The speaker this week is Matt Brown. He is the CEO and owner of Freedom Interventions, one of the nation's leading intervention services for drug and alcohol dependency. And you're gonna enjoy this. Listen, some of you may not be pro-treatment or pro-intervention, and if you're not, please hang in there, okay? Because that's not what this is necessarily about. You really need to listen to this. So some issues are being addressed here as far as codependency goes, and as far as legitimate, real help for the addict and alcoholic and the codependent. Some real good dialogue that took place. This is being held at the Recovery Life Workshop at Oak Creek Christian Center in Albany, Oregon. Here this last Friday, Matt Brown was our guest speaker, and I think if you will give it a chance, you're going to really get some useful information out of this. And quite frankly, there is some real serious stuff here, but there's some real good humor involved as well. So here is Matt Brown, CEO of Freedom Intervention, speaking on the topic of intervention.
100% of addicts get an intervention. There is not a sober addict, whether they're in this room or in any other room, that has not been intervened on. It may not necessarily be by an interventionist. It may be by a guy wearing a badge. Maybe by a guy wearing a stethoscope. But there will be an intervention. And so when I'm talking to families about the intervention process, the first thing I have to get them to understand is that there will be an intervention. And it may be by a mortician. But there will be an intervention. Do they want to control how that's going to happen or not? And of course, with most families where there's addiction, there's codependency. And codependents hear the word control and they like, yes, I want to control that. And so it can be a little bit of an unhealthy dynamic at first. And so that's the first thing that we really have to start to examine. But one thing I want you guys to understand is that there's 20, according to the National Institute on Drug Addiction, they estimate that there's 23 million Americans right now that need to go to treatment, that need recovery. They also estimate that only about 3 million of those individuals will seek treatment this year or get treatment. Why do you guys think those other 20 million are not being addressed? Talk with me here. Why don't you think? What are some of the ideas you have?
Shame.
Okay.
Stigma.
Okay. When you say shame and stigma, what do you mean?
They're ashamed to admit they have a problem.
Okay.
I don't think they want to go through the process of change.
Okay. I think there's probably some truth to that. Huge barrier for a lot of people. Treatment's expensive.
Fear. Denial.
Okay.
They've tried before and it didn't work, so they...
Okay.
Failure.
Yeah. So there's a lot of reasons. Some of them are pretty valid. I mean, that financial barrier is huge. Some of the price tags on these treatment centers, my father-in-law and I were just talking today. He's had knee surgery recently. He had a torn meniscus, and so he's been spending a lot of time in front of the TV. And there is a treatment center in Malibu, California that advertises on TV. And he called me today, and he's like, what do you think of these guys? And I'm not going to mention them by name, but we do not get along.
You can listen to last Wednesday's show. Was it last Wednesday's show?
Yeah,
you can hear about it.
But you know, there are, that's $95,000 a month. Last I heard, I don't know for sure, but last I heard was about $95,000 a month to go to that treatment center. But you will be cured, apparently. There are others like Teen Challenge. That's where my family was going to send me. Had I chosen the other fork in the road and gone, they had a bed ready for me at Teen Challenge. There are other less expensive options out there. Salvation Army, 90-day program, completely free. But you better show up and you better do the work, or they will find someone to take that spot. Yeah. But you know what? When you're out of options, you're out of options. And we'll, you know, part of what I do, every family that calls me may not need an intervention, may not be able to afford an intervention, may not be able to afford treatment. But I try to make the commitment to every family who calls me that if they want help and they're willing to do some legwork, we will find an option for them. So that's, I mean, when you talk about 20 million people just in this year alone that aren't going to get the help that they need, we can only deal with what we can deal with. So let's look at what we can deal with. We talked about shame. We talked about the stigma, denial. That's a huge one. You were the one who said denial, right? Okay, sorry. I'll give you credit. All right. Denial goes both ways. To be honest with you, the first people that have to hit bottom are the people around the addict. If they don't see through their denial, that addict is never going to. The way I try to explain it to families early on is I want you to think of addiction kind of like a fire. If you have something that's burning, let's just use this as an example. If I have something that's burning here, the best way to put that fire out is to take away the oxygen that's around the fire. Doesn't matter what's burning. Without oxygen, that fire cannot exist. Well, the same thing is true with addiction. Doesn't matter if it's booze, alcohol, drugs, gambling, sex, pornography, spending, food, whatever it is. It cannot exist without enabling. In the absence of enabling, addiction cannot survive. So when my family took away my enabling, the first thing I did is I went to the bar to find a new enabler. And she regretted it. She regretted it. I found a girl whose husband was in prison. She had a room open. You know, and so I convinced her that I would be a good bet. You know, I would be able to help her around the house. And, you know, it turns out we ended up falling madly in love. It was one of those, we were meant to be together until her husband got out of prison. And then I was out the door. But I found a new enabler. And so in the absence of enabling, just like fire can't exist, addiction can't exist. And so the first thing we do when we're talking about intervention with families, I want to look at what's going on in the dynamic of the family. I want to be able to identify the enablers that we can control and who are willing to be influenced. And then we also have to consider those that may not necessarily be willing to be influenced. You know, harmful friends. You know, other people that we're in relationships with. Those are, you know, we may not necessarily be able to predict what they're going to, how they're going to react. But the people who come together to support, generally speaking, are willing to take a look at their own behavior. So that's the first thing that we've got to take a look at. I want to talk a little bit, too, about this. And I understand that Eve went over this last week with you guys, but I want to revisit it. Just to kind of understand what addiction is. Addiction is not a drug problem. It's not an alcohol problem. It is a drug and alcohol solution. We start out, we're feeling pain. There's some sense of emotional discomfort going on. Like, just like with me growing up, I was lonely. I didn't feel right. I didn't belong anywhere. And I felt that way until I used. And that use, the effect that it produced, relieve my pain. And so what I got was a sense of ease and comfort. And that threw me into active using. And that lasted until I felt some remorse. So something happened that I felt remorseful for. I slept with somebody's wife. I robbed somebody. I did something that created some remorse in me. It went contrary to principles that I knew were true. You know, we talk in this program about principles before personalities. I firmly believe that when it talks about personalities, it's not talking about your personality. It's talking about my personality. When I feel conflict in my life, it's because my personality is not aligned with correct principles. It has nothing to do with you. I'm out of line with correct principles. And so I'll feel remorse. And of course, I get into this firm resolution to stop using until my pain gets too great that I start to use again because I don't have a solution to combat this pain yet. And so I go into this cycle. And it goes and it goes and it goes until somebody stops it. Now, the same thing is true with those who are in the life of an addict. If you're not necessarily an active addict where you're smoking crack or doing whatever it is that addicts do, maybe you're a codependent. This cycle belongs to you just as well. Your pain may not necessarily be, it might be. Actually, thinking about it, it could very well be the same type of pain that I experienced as an addict. But some people say that addicts are addicted to drugs and alcohol, and codependents are addicted to the addicts. You know, what will happen is you're going to feel this pain until you can find a way to relieve that pain. And usually that's by having some sort of influence or trying to exert some control over someone else in your life or something else in your life. And that provides that ease of comfort because, oh, little Timmy was going to spend 6 months in jail. And I was able to find the right lawyer to keep him from having to go to jail. So I'm a good parent. I kept my kid out of jail. And I'm going to keep enabling him. You know, he was going to be hungry, but I gave him $100 for food. I feel better because my son's not going to be hungry anymore. I feel better. That $100 isn't for him. That $100 was for me. I feel better now that I kept my kid from being hungry. You know, my wife cheated on me. She got drunk and she went and cheated on me. It's not the first time, but I forgave her. She didn't experience any consequences because I'm such a good husband. And we'll work it out, just like we did every other time. And all of a sudden, I'm into active using. I'm not using drugs, I'm using people. And that's the cycle of codependency, just like the cycle of addiction. Until I find some remorse. He did it again. He got arrested for a DUI again. Yeah.
This is one of the questions that I attended these meetings here. Uh-huh. And the thing that, to me, from my point of view, is missing is what was done to the victims.
Tell me who the victims are.
In these meetings, nobody talks about what they did to the victims.
Who are the victims? Help me understand who that is.
Okay, the victims are your family, are the people you stole from, the people the stores you stole from, all the crimes you committed against society. And there's no mention, you know what I mean, of this within what I've seen. And I've seen some things where when you have the victims in the room with the person who's done it, that when the victims get done with them, they're a lot of the time pretty sober about what they've done to them.
Okay. Have you guys gotten into steps 8 and 9?
No, not as good as
okay. Here's why that's important. Here's why the steps are ordered.
Can I add one more thing?
Sure.
Is that I think one of the things I don't know because I'm not there. But one of the things that I've always done when I've had to do something wrong against somebody was to go back and make it right.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right.
And I don't see a process. Or I'm not talking about just the family.
Sure.
I'm talking about the crime. I mean, you know what I'm saying.
I do. I know exactly what you're saying.
So you do, and I can tell that, or you wouldn't be CEO of this intervention thing. So the bottom, and I can see the way you've lived your life, but it's that's what I don't see in the meetings. That's very discussed at all.
Okay. Okay. What I will promise you
okay.
is that it will be discussed.
Okay, thank you.
But there is an order to this. The steps are ordered very specifically. If I punch you in the nose right now, mm-hmm. and I apologize for you for immediately after, how likely are you to accept my apology?
Well, first of all, you could punch back.
I'm not trying to threaten. I'm just speaking in metaphor here.
I know, I understand, but what I'm saying...
We're going to step outside. We'll be right back.
What I'm saying is that unfortunately, if you punch somebody and they didn't punch you back, that's the worst thing that can be done, because then you don't get the feeling of what you've done.
Well, let me continue my metaphor for just a second. The steps really give us an opportunity to examine our lives, to examine our relationships with ourselves, with our higher power, and with our fellow man. The first 7 steps really walk us through that process. By the time we get to step 8, we're beginning that process of examining the people that we've harmed. And we become willing to make direct amends to those people, wherever it's possible. Sometimes it's not possible. Except when to do so would injure them or other people. That's the caveat to step 8. Or step 9, actually. That's step 9. Sorry, I'm getting off track. But step 8, we get with our sponsors. We start making that list of all the people we harm, and we became willing to make amends to them all. Now we move into step 9. The only thing that step 8 asks us to do is to make that list and to get willing to make amends. Step 9, we move into the amends phase. But it's step 8 and 9. There's 7 steps to complete before we get to that point where we really understand that making an amends is not making an apology. So, if you for what we're talking about tonight, we're not quite there.
Okay.
But like Monty said, keep sticking around here, and I promise you, you'll get to it. It's a critical part of this. You know, the Big Book talks about how if we do not fulfill those steps, we are set up for failure. We will return to drink or drugs. Or whatever it is, unless we successfully fulfill those commitments to make those amends.
And I believe you, sir.
Okay.
I want you to know something. I'm not bringing this up to take away from the process.
Oh, I know you're not.
Seven or 8 steps.
Sure.
But what I'm saying is that when something's not, it's kind of like a divorce where two people are arguing all the time, or even with each other, and the kids are standing there, and nobody represents the children.
Sure.
And I don't see in some of these processes anybody representing the kids.
Well, and you will. And what you're probably going to learn through the process, too, is that the addict is just as much a victim as the people around him. That the addict, it's himself or herself, is just as much a victim as the people around them.
Could be.
They could be a victim to their own behaviors, their own thought processes. Oftentimes, we have to find a way to make amends to ourselves. Because the person that I beat up more than anybody was me.
I want you to get back to your point.
Sure.
I just wanted to
so, this is just as valid as it is for the addict as it is to the codependent. You will, if you're in a relationship with an addict, you could probably identify with this on some level. You know, you could probably go back to your bank statements and identify this at some level. So what is the purpose of an intervention? What's the purpose of an intervention? You know, imagine you're in the room, you've got your addict there, you've got your support system there. What do you want to accomplish?
I want them to stop and think.
Okay. What else?
Convince them they need help.
Sorry?
Convince them they need help.
Okay.
Do you need to voice how their behavior has affected you?
Okay.
Save their life.
Ultimately, yes. I mean, when you really sum it up and boil it down to its barest essence, that is exactly what we're trying to do. Everything else that everyone has said is true as well. But there is a process to it. When you know, a lot of times a family has seen the TV show. You know, they see, okay, we got to write letters. We got to figure out how to write these letters. We're going to read some letters. We're all going to write down what we want to say.
We're all
going to
cry.
And we're all going to cry. You know, the Big Book calls it frothy emotional appeal. If you love me enough, you'll get sober. You know, shed a few tears. But if you love me enough, you'll get sober. You know, and we try to appeal to the emotions of a person that has no control over their emotions.
Amen.
You know, I'm going to try to pull on your heartstrings and influence you in a way that's really completely ineffective. And so there is a specific way, and yes, in my interventions I do have families write letters, but more than anything, it's because I need to know what everyone's going to say in that room. When I do an intervention, I do most of the talking. Because if you're the addict in the room, you've heard 100 times what Monty has said. You've learned to turn down the volume when Monty talks. When Monty talks, it's painful. I mean, it is. If you've heard what he's about to say for the 13th, 100th time, turn that volume right down, because I do not want to. Yeah. I should actually be looking at you, because you have more experience. But they've heard it all. And they usually hear it on a one-on-one basis. Because if I'm your brother, and I'm coming to you again, I'm probably coming by myself, and you've learned how to manipulate me. And you've got your other brother over here, and you've learned how to manipulate him in a different way. You've got your sisters in the back row there, and then you've learned how to manipulate them. And each one of us is trying in a very fragmented way to come and bear some influence in your life. And you're telling me one thing, and you're telling them another, and you're telling him something completely different. All in an effort to try to just maintain the status quo. Because if I could just get them to stop, I can keep doing what I'm doing. Because change is scary. Change is hard. And so the purpose of an intervention, just to get back to that, before we ever sit down and do an intervention, we have a plan. What do we want the outcome to be? And yes, we want them to stop and think. And yes, we want them to do everything else that you guys just said. But beyond that, there has to be a call to action. An intervention is a call to action. I have a plan. When that person says, yes, I'm willing to make a change, we have plane tickets booked. If they're going to a treatment center out of town, you know, we have a plan. And as soon as they say yes, we're moving as quickly as we can, because I do not want them changing their mind. Because the mind of an addict will tell them, oh, wait a minute, I'll do this, but I'll do it next week. I'm not doing it today. And so we try to remove all those obstacles. I do want to talk a little bit, too, about, because I think it's an important thing to consider about the intervention process. You know, we're going to talk a little bit more about what the intervention process is, but why treatment? Why not just have them go to AA or NA or CA? Why not have them come here? Why should people consider treatment? And I'm not here to promote treatment centers, but I'm here to talk about the idea of what treatment is. Why do you guys think that treatment is, whether it's inpatient, outpatient, whatever, why do you think there are so many of them?
There's a need.
Well, there's a need, yeah. It works. I mean, it really does. And I'm not necessarily, like I said, I'm not here to promote treatment centers. But giving someone the opportunity to unplug from their lives, step away from the things that, I hate to use the word triggers. I mean, I hate that word. But to really just unplug from life. Stop having to go through the day-to-day cycles that have gotten us stuck, that haven't worked for us in the past, and really go to a place where we can learn to do it someone else's way, depending on what the needs are. Because when Monty got sober, while I'm sure we could find some common ground in our stories, his circumstances, I'm sure, were very different from mine. And if I tried hard enough, I could try to tell you that I'm not an alcoholic, because I'm not like that guy. And I'm not like this guy. And so I could, but if you pull me out of that, if you shift the paradigm that I'm in and really get me to look at something a different way and help me to understand why my way didn't work for me and show me any way to do it in a safe environment where you can keep me from going home at night and getting drunk, where you can detox me in a safe environment and provide a way for me to learn new behaviors and new thought processes and come to an... I think, I say this all the time, if treatment centers can do two things, they're a solid treatment center in my mind. If they can make a good member of a recovery community, like AA or NA, if they can create someone who's going to become a lifelong member of one of those organizations and provide a place for someone to come and have a spiritual experience, you've got someone started on the road to recovery. There's more to it than that, and that's really simplifying things quite a bit. Somebody may have been the victim of severe abuse or trauma, physical, sexual, mental, emotional, whatever that is. Sometimes that requires a special therapeutic touch. Sometimes there's underlying mental health issues, depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, schizophrenia. I mean, there's so many different things that can contribute to the underlying problem. But unless someone can get to the point where they can really examine ultimately why their decision-making process is broken, why this the way I make choices does not work for me, because it's based on this. When I base my decision-making process around this, usually around this word right here, because if you told me, Matt, if you make this choice, this will be the consequence. When I'm feeling this, when I'm in pain, I don't care what the consequence is. I want to stop feeling this. And if the consequence isn't coming till tomorrow, but I can stop feeling pain today, give me some. I will put it in my mouth and I will stop feeling pain. I will put it in my arm and I will stop feeling pain. As long as I don't have to experience the consequence till later. And that's what the cycle keeps me, that's how I stayed stuck in this. Yeah.
I was sat in at a couple interventions when I was going, you know, through my addiction with alcohol, and those interventions were like, because my wife and I, we lived with her parents for a little while. When everything came crashing in, we ended up moving in with her parents. But I felt, you know, I felt being attacked. You know, they call it intervention, but I felt like I was being attacked. I had nobody really. There was nobody neutral.
Right.
It was her parents and her, and I felt, and that's the way I felt. And I would like walk out of these things, and you know, they'd kick me out of the house, you know, because I'd start flaring up and getting angry, and I'd stay outside all night.
You bet.
And just drink, and you know, that's the way, just to kill any of that pain or whatever. So none of those interventions helped.
Right.
What they called interventions.
Exactly. Because it really wasn't, I mean, it was their best effort.
Right.
They were doing the best they could with what they knew how in the moment. And I don't want to criticize them, because I think they were trying to do something noble. They were trying to save your life in the best way that they knew how to do it. Right. Unfortunately, their best way was just like my parents' best way. They thought that if they could show me how much pain I was creating for them, that it would create a desire for me to change.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work. When you try to appeal to me and say, "You're hurting me, Matt. The choices you're making are hurting me, and I want you to stop." That's just another form of me getting on my knees and, "Please stop. Please, please, please." Just got a little guilt thrown in there.
That's one of the worst things that you could hear somebody tell an addict, is like, their biggest thing is like, "Well, just quit."
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you can't do that as an addict. You can't just quit.
You know, my dad, to this day, I don't think he understands it.
Right.
I called him. He's a tax accountant, in addition to what his work in the church does. And I had some tax questions for him, because he and I, our relationship is great today, by the way. I don't want you guys to walk out here thinking my dad's a jerk, because he's not. He doesn't understand addiction, and he probably never will. I called him on my 10-year sobriety birthday, because I had a tax question. It's in April, and I had a tax question. And I said, "By the way, Dad, I'm 10 years sober today." Still, 10 years later, trying to get him to approve of me. And the first thing he says to me is, "You're still doing that, huh?" I'm like, "Well, it's worked for 10 years. I think I'm going to stick with it." But, you know, it's that same thing of, you know, people just don't understand the process. They think, "Well, why don't you just stop? Just stop."
Yep.
You know, it's like me saying, "Hold your breath and don't ever breathe again." Just don't. Just don't breathe. Our bodies just have this involuntary reaction. We are going to breathe. Same thing for the addict. We are going to use. Unless we're provided with an alternative solution to solve the cause of our pain. And that's what the steps are designed for. That's what treatment is designed to get somebody in touch with and lay the foundation for. And so when families talk about hitting bottom, is hitting bottom necessary?
No.
Who here drives a nice car? A car they really, really like. What do you drive?
Dodge Challenger.
Okay. Is it new?
Yeah.
So it's not a classic. It's a new one. What would you do? What would you do if you felt like it was running a little bit rough? Would you wait till it broke down all the way and just completely stop running?
No, it had some scratches on it. We went and got it fixed right away.
Okay. But yet some people will take the possessions, or I shouldn't say possessions, the people that are the most valuable to them, and they'll wait until they are completely broken down before they'll do anything. Because there's this myth that if they don't hit bottom, they're not going to get well. I mean, things that are possessions that are valuable to us, you know, get a couple of scratches on them, We're freaking out. I got to get this fixed. But yet the people that are struggling and suffering needlessly go through pain. And the people around them, you as a family member, go through needless pain. So the purpose of an intervention is to provide a bottom. It's to create a bottom or show someone the bottom before they actually have to reach it. And so what will happen, and just to kind of walk you guys through what happens during a typical intervention. We'll go through different intervention models because this isn't the only way to do an intervention. But one of the things that I have families prepared to do is the first thing I want them to do when they're writing this letter, there's three paragraphs to this letter. It's always very short. I don't want them to go on for minutes because you're going to lose the attention of the person that you're trying to intervene on. But the first paragraph of this letter is usually an expression of love. I want you, if you're intervening on me, I want you to tell me why I'm important to you. Why you feel I'm worth you showing up and interrupting your life to come and talk to me about this. If there's an experience that really, where we connected, where maybe it defined who we are in a relationship together, even if you don't think I'll remember what that is, I want you to remind me of that. Because I may have forgotten who I am to you. I may have forgotten my value, my worth to you. And so I want to set the stage with them understanding we are here because you are worthy and you are loved. And this is not about shaming you. This is not about providing an experience where you feel guilty. All of that's out of the way. And we are here with nothing just but love and concern. And so that sets the stage. That sets the tone. We get rid of all that judgmental. We get rid of all the shame. We get rid of all the guilt. And we move into the second paragraph of the letter where we start to talk about the truth. Because we're going to talk about this in a way that we've never talked about it before. We're not going to be afraid because that's the addict's, the addiction. I shouldn't say the addict because we're really dealing with the addiction, not the addict. The addiction's best tool is fear and discomfort. If every time you come and talk to me about, if every time when I come and talk to you about your addiction, if you can make it my problem or if you can make me feel guilty for even bringing it up, I'm going to stop because I don't like that. And you're going to get to keep doing what you're doing. And so we're going to talk about this in a different way. And we're not going to let fear control us anymore. Because now we're a group. I'm not coming to you as an individual. We're coming as a group. It may just be two of us. There may be 15 of us in that room. But we're all going to come with a consistent message of love and support. We're also going to talk about the truth. And in that second paragraph, we begin with the statement, your addiction has affected me in the following ways. Not you. Not your bad choices. Your addiction. We're going to separate the two now. Because you are not your addiction. And I make that very clear. You are not your bad choices. Because quite frankly, you're probably not responsible for most of the choices you made. And I'm going to let the family, in a very non-shameful way, outline how they have been affected. By saying, when you drive under the influence, I'm fearful that you might hurt yourself or someone else. When you steal money from me, I'm worried for my financial security. It's about feelings at this point. Because if I come to you and I talk to you about facts, that can be argued. I can argue with you about facts all day long. But I can't argue with you about how you're feeling. So when you tell me that my addiction has caused you to feel something, you're disarming my ability to argue with you. It's no longer a tug of war. I have to sit there and listen to how you're feeling about my addiction. And that moves us into the third paragraph. And now we come up with a solution. Just like it says in the big book, there is a solution. Most of us don't like it, but there's a solution. And here it is. If you will choose to go to treatment today, this is how I'm prepared to support you. This is how, as a group, we are prepared to not see you fail. If you will do this. However, if you choose not to go to treatment today, or engage at whatever level of care we feel like you need, whether it's outpatient, inpatient, 12-step meetings, whatever it is, therapy, psychiatry. Here's how I'm going to change my behavior so I'm no longer the oxygen for your fire. Here's how I'm going to change my behavior so I'm no longer contributing to the problems that you've chosen to stay attached to. I'm offering you a solution. You don't have to do it this way. Just like when you're sitting in a room full of your family and your in-laws and they're telling you what a bad guy you are, there was no solution. My family, they tried to offer me a solution. They didn't really understand how to help me understand what that solution was. But at least they were trying. It sounds to me like in the way you gave your account, there really was no solution. They just wanted you to change. Just change.
You're preaching at me.
Yeah. And so we've got to provide a way out. We can't bring somebody and say, I want you to change. Good luck. You know, we've got to provide a way for them to exit the problem. And so we're doing that. Here's what will happen if you choose to follow our direction. Your decision-making process is compromised. We don't want you to negotiate the outcome. We are not here to negotiate with you. We are here to make you an offer. And here's what that offer is. We want you to go to 90 days of treatment in such and such a facility. You will be hopping on an airplane with Matt, your new best friend. And you will be flying away to treatment this afternoon. We have flights are already booked. We're ready to go. Or you'll be taking a drive down the road. You know, half an hour from now, they're waiting to check you into the treatment program. Got your bags packed. They're in the car already. All you have to do is get up and walk to the car with Matt. We remove the obstacles. And then once they say yes, we execute that plan. Now, most of the time, what I've just described to you probably happens in the first 20 minutes. And about this many people choose to go to treatment in that first 20 minutes. Now, occasionally it will happen. I love telling this story. There was one time I was in Waco, Texas. There was a young man who was going to Baylor University. He was an Army reservist who had been deployed to Afghanistan twice as a sniper. And he had taken lives. And he was a violent, violent drunk. And we expected him to be drunk, and we expected him to be violent. And so I had his platoon mates there in the room with me. Because if anybody could hold him down, it was going to be these guys. They were about twice my size. And so his brother went to his house to pick him up to come over to hang out with some buddies. And lo and behold, it's an intervention. He walks in the room. He sees his mom sitting over there. He sees his two brothers, and he sees the rest of his platoon sitting right there. He hits his knees and just begins to weep. Mm-hmm. And he said, God came to me last night and told me help was on the way. Where am I going? And at that point, there wasn't a dry eye in the room. But it was just like, you never know who is being prepared and in what way to have this experience. God just paves the way sometimes. Sometimes he makes us work for it. And so very few people in those first few moments of the intervention are prepared to follow direction because they think they have options. I mean, how many of you guys who are in recovery kept using because you didn't think you had to quit? You had options. You had people that were going to continue to enable you. I don't have to quit. My mom and dad are going to keep writing checks. And when that stops, they're going to give me a place to stay. I'll get my old room back. Mom will do my laundry. She'll cook my food. Everything's going to be okay. Until it wasn't. Until I was out of options. And so when we can properly convince them that the enabling is gone, to the best of our ability, we are removing the enabling. They're left with a choice. Continue to live life the way they've decided to live it, or live it a different way. And we usually ask them to make that choice in a pretty short amount of time. Because, like I said, the mind of an addict is our worst enemy. We can talk ourselves out of a good thing really, really easily. And so with the room there full of people who love them, who have not judged them once to the best of their ability, and provided them with a loving, compassionate experience, about 85 to 90% of the time, we're going to treatment. And it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. One of my favorite things about my job, whether I'm in the car with them or whether I'm on a plane with them, is seeing them fall asleep. I love that. Because the fight's over. I get to see them. I'm sitting there next to them on the plane. And some of them fall on my shoulder. Some of them snore. Some of them drool. It's awesome. Because I just get to see that fight go out of them. It's over. I don't have to fight anymore. I might fight tomorrow, but I'm done fighting for today. And it's just a really, really cool thing. The next struggle at that point, because when I get that person into treatment, my job's not over. I'm going to be working with that family for at least 6 months after that. Because I can have you go to treatment, and I can have you go have a wonderful spiritual experience. You can work the steps, you can have a spiritual awakening, and then you get to come back home to those people that sat you in the room and told you that you needed to change. And they've not progressed. And so it's a systemic issue. The family has to progress. So if I send you to treatment and you have a great experience, but I haven't helped your family to engage in recovery for themselves, there's a really good chance you're going to come back home and learn to enable them, or to get them to enable you again, And your mind will tell you that it's okay because I went to treatment and I'm not drinking. But maybe I'll borrow some money from my parents again. Because I really don't have to work. And maybe I'll lie to them about when I'm going to pay it back. And the little things start again. And the details come back. And all of a sudden, we're right back into the cycle. We may not have necessarily begun to experience this yet, but it's not far behind. Because maybe we'll experience some remorse about something else. And it leads to this, and it leads to that. And it just we can get into the cycle at any point. It doesn't always start here. So that's one model of intervention. That's called the Johnson model of intervention. Vernon Johnson was a guy, he was an Episcopal preacher back in the 1960s, I think. I got the actual dates here. Hang on. Yeah, 1960s. He started what's called the Johnson Institute up in Minnesota. And he actually had therapists from all over the country come and train with him to do interventions. And it was very, very confrontational. Johnson model interventions today don't look like they did back then. But I love this quote. He wrote a book in 1973 called I'll Quit Tomorrow. He said, "It is a myth that alcoholics have some spontaneous insight and then seek treatment. Victims of this disease do not submit to treatment out of spontaneous insight. Typically, in our experience, they come to their recognition scenes through a buildup of crises that crash through their almost impenetrable defense systems. They are forced to seek help, and when they don't, they perish miserably." And then, like Monty said, on my website, I have a quote, and I'm going to look that up here real quick. Nora Volkov, who's the director of the National Institute on Drug Addiction, who I normally would not quote because they're not real spiritual friendly. And I do believe that addiction is a medical disease with a spiritual solution. Here's what she says. "Treatment does not need to be voluntary to be effective. Sanctions or enticements from the family, employment settings, and or the criminal justice system can significantly increase the treatment entry, retention rates, and ultimate success of drug treatment interventions." They've done a lot of studies on how people get into recovery. Some people hit that bottom and have that awakening, that moment of clarity, and say, okay, you know what, I need to do something different. Some people get sent by a judge to their first AA meeting. Some people have something tragic happen to them, and that motivates them. Act of God, if you will. As they look at outcome studies of people going into treatment, and how they got there versus how people leave treatment, what they're finding is it doesn't matter how people get to treatment. What matters is what happens while they're in treatment. If they can have the right experience in treatment, because most addicts don't hit bottom before they get sober. Most addicts hit bottom after they already get sober, like I did. 3 months into my sobriety, I'm miserable. And I'm either going to drink or I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to find God. And I found God. And it saved my life. But it doesn't matter how it got there. What matters is what happens once I was there. And that's what they're finding with treatment, whether it's in 12-step, in an inpatient setting, in an outpatient setting. I mean, there are certain statistical things that really do play to the success rates of treatment centers. Length of stay, clinical training of the staff. I mean, there's a lot of things that contribute. But in the big picture, as you take a look at the industry as a whole, doesn't matter how people are going to treatment. Yeah.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. How important is it when someone is in treatment that the treatment center is communicating with the person that is closest to them?
That sounds like it might be a question from personal experience.
It is.
Okay. And I'm not I don't mean that to be a criticism, but you're touching on a very, very important point.
Well, he's my ex-husband. He's been through treatment once before. He has currently going through IOP. Mm-hmm. No one's contacted me.
There's two reasons why that won't happen.
He's given them permission.
Okay, that's one of the reasons
why. He's given them permission. He gave them permission when he was in treatment, and the only people they contacted were his parents. And I don't know if the treatment center is aware. His parents are alcoholics. Mm-hmm. His father used to beat the living daylights out of him. So what honesty are they getting from them? And where he's at now, I haven't heard anything from anyone.
Yeah. And so, depending on the training of the staff and their understanding of big picture solutions, there are treatment programs that call them client-centered, uh-huh. The process, I hate that word, by the way, client-centered, which basically means they let the clients dictate how treatment's going to happen. If what I'm doing to you as a therapist or asking you to do, I'm not doing it to you, but asking you to participate in, is uncomfortable to you, and you don't like that, if I'm operating in a client-centered treatment program or treatment model, that's my cue to back off and because I don't want to create pain for you. And I think that's absolute rubbish.
You know, because I've been trying to work on me, and from the first time he went to where he's at now, I mean, I still struggle. I admit I'm a huge codependent, but there's steps I have worked on. Since he's been in rehab the second time, he has relapsed. Mm-hmm. He actually showed up at my house intoxicated with some beer. I got him to stay there, and I informed him the next morning that he was never allowed to come to my house with alcohol. I probably should have said when he's been drinking, but I at least stepped up the boundary of, okay, never show up my door with alcohol.
There you go. That's your next move. Good.
You know, but it frustrates me that no one has spoken with me when I'm the person. I mean, I've been in his life for over 10 years. Okay. I know him better than anybody, including his parents.
Now, before I say what I'm going to say, mm-hmm. I want you to know that I'm about to step on your toes.
Okay, and I'm fine with
that. What makes you think that you have any control over what happens with him?
I don't. I know I don't.
Okay, because what you're saying, though, is I know him better than anybody.
Well, I don't know him better than he knows himself, but I mean...
But just listen for a second. Try to just sit with this, okay? You're trying to talk so that you don't have to listen to what I'm saying. What's happening is you're feeling like your needs aren't being met. Your pain isn't being relieved.
Yes, I agree with that, yeah. Because like I said, I still admit I'm codependent. Still have that, you know.
And believe me when I say this, I am not trying. You've given me a gift here right now that I don't want to let go, because this is not just for you. This is for everybody in this room.
That's fine.
You're feeling some pain.
Yeah.
Because they're not doing things the way you want them done.
I'm just not understanding.
Exactly.
It is my thing.
Okay.
Because I know I can't do anything to help him. I have to help me. I know.
Right.
That.
So what? Oops, I'm going to fall on my face here. So what you want to do is you want to use, which means I got to get in a mix with this guy somehow. Whether it's with his therapist, whether it's with him,
yeah.
I got to get in the mix because I need this. I'm uncomfortable. And then once they do call you and say, here's what's going on with him, this is what you're going to feel.
Yeah. That's true.
And then you're going to get right back into this. And then this is going to happen at some point when he shows up at your house with beer again. And then you're going to have that firm resolution. Oh, that boundary didn't work. I'm going to re-engage with that boundary until this happens again. Mm-hmm. And you're in this cycle. And so I'm going to tell you what somebody told me early on in the program is, you got nothing he needs right now.
Yeah.
And that may sound harsh, but that's the reality of it. He's got his own process of disease that he's in. And he may or may not be ready to jump out of it. But this is your ex, right?
This is my ex, and I guess it's just hard for me because I know his, right now he lives in a house where there's an addict, and I guess he's choosing for that person to be there, but I know everyone he hangs around with are addicts.
Are you living with an addict?
With myself, as a codependent.
Okay. But you've got no addict living with you, and you want one!
I agree with that!
You know, and it's amazing. It is. And I love the way you're handling this. And thank you so much for handling it this way, because most people won't. But this is so, this really solidifies this whole process of exactly what we're talking about. And I can't tell you how many times I'm on the phone with parents who are saying exactly what you're saying. If they would just do it the way I want them to, this would all be okay. Don't they know that I know how to fix this?
Well, I know I don't know how to fix it.
But your mind tells you that you do.
I want to be helpful to him, take care.
There you go.
That codependent part is...
Yes!
I want to take care, you know.
Yes!
I mean, I admit that fully.
So that's where you're at in this cycle.
I used to be.
This is where you're at right now.
Yeah.
So what do you have to do to not go here? Now that you're aware, you can't stay here. You can't stay here, or this will happen. He will move back in, and he will spend your money, and he will eat your food, and he will be the tornado in your life again. Do you want that?
No.
So you have to figure out what to do with this. And that's where this comes in. You have some steps here that you can follow that will keep you from feeling that pain anymore without using. And it will open you up to a spiritual experience that you can love this man and never have him be a part of your life again. And you will trust God enough to do for him what he will do for you. God will do for you exactly what he will do for this man if you'll step back and let God take over. And that's what step two is about. You may have just had a step one experience. We'll see. We'll see. It depends on whether or not you go here. You might have had a step one experience tonight. It depends on whether or not you can hang on to this and remember and use this to catapult you into step two and really come to understand just how powerful God is for you and just how much he can do for you if you'll get out of the way. You make a decision in step three to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. It's not an idea. It's not a philosophy. It's a decision that requires some action attached to it. And we may have gone in a whole new direction tonight than where I saw it, but this was so beautiful to see you and share this with everyone. Thank you. Now, do you have a sponsor?
Do I? It's a yes or no question.
Sounds like it's a no. Get a sponsor. Get someone who's in Al-Anon or CODA or someone here who has been through the steps, who understands how to take this and use those steps to solve this rather than move here. And you will begin to have that experience. And you'll get to steps 8 and 9 like he was talking about earlier. Well, you'll see.
It's so flipping hard.
It is.
You know, you got past it, and then you fall back into it.
How many of you guys have wanted instant gratification before? It's so hard. But you know what? When you get on the other side of this, and you just see, this is one of the things that I love. In Malachi, one of my favorite scriptures ever, talks about how the Lord is like a refiner's fire. If I'm a miner and I go into the earth and I'm extracting precious metals or gemstones, it doesn't come out of the ground all nice and shiny and polished and ready to make, you know, it's dirty, it's filthy, it has impurities in it. It has to go through a process to become the valuable thing that it is. And that process can be painful. It gets heated to some pretty extreme temperatures. And what happens is those impurities rise to the top. And a goldsmith comes along and scoops those away. We don't have anything to do with that. We just have to be prepared and have to be willing to go through the refiner's fire so they come to the surface and it creates that willingness for those to go away. The master comes in and takes it away. And then we're left as precious. We're valuable. We're useful. We can do something and we can be something because we've allowed ourselves to go through that process. And that's what recovery is. It's hard. It's painful. We have to look at stuff we never wanted to look at. You probably have some stuff that has gone on in your life that you just would be very happy putting in a little box and putting it on a shelf.
We all do.
But this process is going to require you to look at that again. And say, okay, why do I make decisions based on something that happened when I was 7 or 10 or 15? Why I'm a grown man. Why do I still have arguments with my dad in my head? And why does he win? You know, it's like we got to get the impurities out. And unless we're willing to submit to the fire, we can't. And when I'm meeting with somebody on that first day, when we're sitting with them in the intervention, I know I can look at them and say, buddy, just hang on. We're going to get you through this because they're feeling what you're feeling right now is it's scary. I don't want to do it.
I hate it because I guess you could say I relapsed because I was doing really good, really strong, doing all right. I got divorced, I moved out, lived on my own, loving life. And then you just slowly crept back in there and I opened the door wider and wider and wider. And I fell back in.
Yeah, because you were in pain. And you had no ability to regulate that emotion. You let him come in to try to regulate it. Just like I let cocaine regulate it. Or whiskey. Or meth. Or whatever it was. Women. Whatever it was. Something had to externally regulate my emotions because I could not do it. Until I let God do it. And that's what recovery is all about. So, I think what you're going through is pretty cool. You may not feel it right now, and that's okay. Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I've observed with things like what we're doing here at Recovery Life is there are people, perhaps, in this room in the last 4 weeks, or have been, or will be in the future, particularly within the faith community, that have determined this will be a good opportunity for me to learn how to fix them.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they find, if they're honest, open, and willing, is that this isn't about fixing them. This is because here the truth of the matter is, even the people in my life, I'm thinking, why should I go to that meeting? He's the horse's patoot. He or she's the one that's doing the drinking or the using or the whatever, not me. Why should I be...
I'm not sick. He is.
I'm not sick. He is. When the truth of the matter is, many times, the family member or the loved one is sicker.
Yeah. Well, guys, we're at 9 o'clock, and I don't want to keep people late, but guys, I can't tell you how great this has been. Thank you. Well, tell me your name again.
Candy.
I can't tell you how proud I am that you got so vulnerable tonight.
Yes.
With a complete stranger. And you let me step on your toes, and you let me just share some of my own experience with you, and I wish nothing but a difficult, painful, lovely...
hang on,
let me finish.
Let me finish.
Wonderful process of recovery for you. Because what's going to happen on the other side of this is you are going to be so strong.
Mm-hmm. And I just kicked myself because, like I said, I felt like I was doing really, really good, and then I just fell.
But one day... everything that you're going through right now will be of use to someone else. And you'll be able to pass it on. Because there will be someone who's going to say, I thought it was a good idea to let my drunk ex-husband sleep on my couch. And you're going to be able to say, let me tell you from my experience why that wasn't such a good idea. And you're going to be able to relieve someone else of making the same mistakes that you've made.
Yeah.
Thank you all, guys. It's been really nice to be here tonight. And anytime I can come back, I'd love to.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much, Matt. What an incredible gift you have for communicating with us some of the solutions to the problems of alcoholism and addiction. It is so vitally important that organizations like Freedom Interventions is known to the public, to the addicts, alcoholics, and to the families and friends of folks who are afflicted. And for those of us who are affected, thank you so much. It is so appreciated. We're going to be having Matt back here in the very near future. Well, hey, listen, my friends, please visit recoverylife.org. You can listen and discover more about the organization Recovery Life, which we started from grassroots right here in Albany, Oregon. We're not affiliated with any particular 12-step fellowship, but we are old school. We do use the Little Red Book, the original 12-step working guide that came out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We are faith-based. But we are all inclusive and open to anyone who is willing to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Recoverylife.org. Check it out. And you can also visit Matt's website at freedominterventions.com. Of course, our website here at Take 12 Radio, take12radio.com on your internet dial. Until our next broadcast, this is The Monty Man, and I'm wishing God's perfect serenity for you. Bye bye now.
Without the booze, I've been living, that's a fact. Without the booze,
I've been making my way back.
Without the booze, I've been learning day by day to let it go and stay out of my own way. stay out of my own way.
This has been a broadcast of KHLT Recovery Broadcasting.